Hey guys, and welcome to the Heavy Lies the Helmet, aka the Health Podcast. We are your host Mike Boone, along with my brother Brian Boone, and this is episode 12. So calcium is an extremely important electrolyte, which is why we wanted to cover it before we focused on some other content for our podcasts. So we're going to include it in our electrolyte series here. The reason behind this is because we find extremely high levels of calcium in our body. It makes up a lot of our body weight. So it's important to know when we have a dysregulation, the effects it's going to have, because it can have significant effects on our critically ill patients. Not to mention, most of us in our ambulances and aircrafts carry calcium. Now, this might be in the form of gluconate or chloride, but for the most part, it's a readily available medication to administer. So it's really important for us to understand when it's truly indicated, and then also the effects that it's going to have on your patient when you're administering this. So we want to make sure that we cover that. And we're going to primarily be focusing on hypocalcemia because we find that it's much more of a clinical significance, and really your emergent states in these critically ill patients is going to be relative to low calcium levels and not high calcium levels. So just keep that in mind. The easiest way is to break down where calcium is located, because it's located in several different areas in our body. I think most people associate calcium with bones, and rightfully so, because 99% of our total body calcium is found in the bones. And you might hear this referred to as calcium phosphate or hydroxyapatite. But what we're really going to focus on is the calcium that's going to be regulatory and biologically active in our bodies. And we find this in that 1% or less than 1%. And these are the calcium levels that are located in the intracellular and extracellular compartments, and more so in the intracellular. We see that even though there's a total of about 5 to 6 grams of calcium in those intracellular and extracellular compartments, only about 1.3 grams of that is located extracellularly. Now, when we're measuring this, when we're measuring plasma concentrations of calcium, in general, before we get into ionized, we look at values of 4.5 to 5.1 milliequivalents per liter. But if you're measuring in milligrams per deciliter, it's going to be different, obviously, and we find the range to be 8 to 10.2. So just keep that in mind, because it can be a little confusing when you're monitoring these electrolytes in our patients and you're not familiar with that unit of measure. When we're focusing specifically on that plasma calcium, we kind of mentioned ionized, and there's a reason behind that. It's because ionized makes up the majority of that plasma concentration, about 50%. And the other percentages, we find about 40% is bound to proteins, which 90% of that, I know this is a lot of numbers, but just keep in mind that primarily, the calcium that's not ionized is bound to albumin. That's the easiest way to remember it. And we'll touch a little bit on how you'll see that relationship affect one another. And then that 10% that's left over, we see bound to other anions. So this can be phosphate, carbonate, citrate, lactate. Some of these things can be a little bit harder to measure, but just something to make mention of. We already mentioned the importance of ionized calcium. The reason behind that is because ionized calcium is that free-flowing calcium, that calcium that's really going to affect our patients. And this is regulated by the parathyroid hormone, or PTH. Other big players in this are vitamin D and calcitonin, which we're going to touch on a little bit more as we get into treatment, but it is worth mentioning those things so you understand how that's going to affect our calcium levels when we're administering these specific things, or when we have a dysregulation of the parathyroid hormone.
So when we talk about ionized versus total serum calcium, we have to realize, too, that this is affected by plasma pH. So as our pH changes, the percentage of total serum calcium that is bound to albumin is affected. And we'll talk a little bit more as we talk about the hypo-hyper states, but At a plasma pH of 7.4, so our normal body pH, each gram of albumin binds 0.8 milligrams per deciliter of calcium. So really, that's just something to keep in mind. Again, we're mostly focused on ionized here. When we talk about a normal value of ionized calcium, now we have to remember that it depends on how we're measuring it. Usually, the labs that we see in the hospital, they're looking at milligrams per deciliter, so you may see a normal range of 4.5 to 5.5 milligrams per deciliter. Our iStats, it results in millimoles per liter, and the normal range for that is 1.2 to 1.32. So something to remember, if you use an iStat and you get a reported value of an ionized calcium from a receiving facility, it may not be measuring the same values. If you're looking at total calcium values, that's one of the reasons why it is not a great measure to look at, is because the pH drastically affects it and the total albumin level drastically affects it. So that's why really we're focusing on ionized. And also, most of us are using, or a lot of us are using, point of care testing and iStat point of care analyzers. So as far as pH, we know that acidemia decreases calcium binding to albumin and alkalemia increases the binding. So if the patient is alkalotic, we will see a decrease in ionized calcium. And again, we'll talk about that as a cause for hypocalcemia. So when we talk about calcium regulation, as Mike mentioned, there's a lot of body systems that help us to regulate this. But this is very important because calcium regulation, it's critical for a lot of different body functions. Cellular function, neural transmission, membrane stability, muscle contraction, bone structure, and blood coagulation. All of these things are affected by calcium regulation. And we'll talk about those individually as we get into some of the symptoms of our dysregulation of our calcium and some things that we can affect by administering calcium supplementation. So we know that calcium regulation is primarily managed by parathyroid hormone and vitamin D. Parathyroid hormone is released from the parathyroid gland, obviously, and it causes a release of calcium from the bone stores. So those osteoclasts are activated, and it helps to break down the calcium from the bone and releases it into the serum. As the parathyroid hormone increases, our serum calcium will increase. It also causes an increase in renal absorption, which also causes an increase in serum calcium, and it also causes a decrease in phosphorus. We know vitamin D, many people are familiar how vitamin D is very crucial for calcium absorption in the gastrointestinal system. We know that this is acquired both by dietary sources and through sunlight. And really how this takes place, so the kidney, the renal system, it releases calcitriol. This is the hormonally bioactive metabolite of vitamin D. So this is what the body turns vitamin D into, which causes the gastrointestinal absorption. Calcitonin is another hormone that decreases the calcium and the phosphorus.
So let's get in specifically to the different states. And like I said before, we're going to mention and focus primarily on hypocalcemia. And this can be caused by a number of things. Some of the big things are other electrolytes. We've talked a lot in this series how the various electrolytes affect each other in certain ways, and this is no exception. One of the causes of this is hyperphosphatemia. So if you have high phosphorus levels in the body, calcium binds to phosphorus. So the more phosphorus you have, the more binding that's going to occur, and thus the lower serum levels you're going to see. Just because this has an inverse relationship, it's not necessarily the case with other electrolytes. So magnesium, for example. What we find is when you have low magnesium levels, you have low calcium levels. And the reason behind this is because magnesium is one of the contributing factors for release of parathyroid hormone, which we talked about how that increases body calcium levels. So if you have a low magnesium level, you're going to have a low calcium level because you're not going to have that production. So any kind of dysregulation with the parathyroid, we talked about, obviously this is going to have an effect. vitamin D deficiency, resistance, rhabdo, numerous things. Malignancy is also a big one, which we find more so in hypercalcemia, which we'll make mention of. But the biggest thing that is probably most applicable to us, or at least one of the biggest things, is our trauma patients. So if we have a trauma patient who's experiencing hemorrhagic shock, a common treatment for that is obviously the transfusion of packed red blood cells. A lot of transport companies now are carrying those things. Or even in the emergency department or ICU setting, if you have a person who's got acute bleeding and they're requiring massive transfusion, by using that banked blood, you can actually lower calcium levels. And the reason behind that is because that banked blood has citrate, which is a preservative to help, which helps maintain the usage of that blood. Well, the problem is that citrate binds to calcium. So if we're giving a number of packed red cells, a number of units, really we need to be looking at their calcium levels. And even if we don't have a specific calcium level, this is something that we can go ahead and administer because we know that this is going to occur whether it's happening or not. So we can go ahead, get that prophylactic calcium on board, and that's going to prevent hypocalcemia. Now, the tricky thing with calcium levels and hypocalcemia, and this is applicable to hyper too, but you really don't see signs and symptoms until you get more extreme values. But by that point, you're really looking at an emergency. Now, with hypocalcemia, I think probably one of the most common things we think about is tetany or neuromuscular irritability. The reason you see tetany in these cases is because calcium helps regulate sodium channels in nerve cells. It helps create that action potential, open up those sodium channels. Well, when you don't have enough calcium, the body tries to make up for that and it generates these spontaneous action potentials. Well, what happens is that affects the skeletal muscle. And then you start to see these spontaneous contractions, which is tetany. So just keep that in mind, the reason behind that. I think that a lot of us know that tetany is a symptom of hypocalcemia, but why that is the case. And then we're also going to get in a little bit to alkalemia and acidemia. Now, it's interesting because your alkalemia can actually induce tetany because, as we talked about, alkalemia is typically accompanied by low ionized calcium levels, whereas acidemia is more protective. Now, if you have a rapid correction of acidemia or just a simple development of alkalemia on that other side of the spectrum, you can trigger tetany as well. So not only do we need to be concerned about the level of ionized calcium, but we also need to be cognizant of how fast we're treating these things and if we're contributing to these things.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I had a hard time grasping the reason why patients had tetany and hypocalcemia, because I always think of calcium as a positive inotrope, which we will talk about why that happens here in a second. But so for there to be more muscle contractions, it was confusing to me. So evidently, you talked about the action potential. So it opens up those sodium channels. So that's really what causes the muscle contraction. It actually can cause seizure activity, is those voltage-gated sodium channels that open and cause that muscle contraction. So it's different than a controlled increased inotropy, which we'll talk about in a second, but I found that interesting. When we get into the treatment of hypocalcemia, we know that whether or not we treat this depends on a lot of things. It's going to depend on the severity. It's going to depend on the patient's situation, what type of symptoms they're having, and that really is going to drive whether or not we need to start supplementing calcium. Most times that we see hypocalcemia, usually this is going to be mild. It's not going to be something that the patient is seizing from. Typically, like Mike mentioned, we'll just see it on the lab value. One of the things that we will see a lot of times in our patients is hypotension, however, and that's one of the things that we want to talk about because calcium is a strong inotrope. And the reason why is that if you remember your anatomy of a muscle cell, so you have actin and you have myosin, and those two fibers, they work together like almost like Velcro. You have the little hooks on the myosin, the little myosin heads, which grab the actin and they pull it, and it causes the muscle to contract. Well, which helps to activate that myosin head is troponin. So troponin C is activated by calcium. So that's really how calcium causes positive inotropy. Calcium attaches to that troponin C, which causes that those myosin heads to be activated, and it causes an increase in muscle contraction. So if we see this in our patients, it's something to think about that we need to start supplementing. Also, if we see these neurological symptoms such as tetany, seizures, those would be things, arrhythmias as a result of this, that would be something that we would need to treat. We talked about how measuring direct ionized calcium is important. If we're not able to do that, if we get a lab from a sending facility and it's not ionized and we don't have iStat analyzers, just remember that we have to consider their albumin level. So one way that we can correct for that, if that is the situation that you're in, is you can add 0.8 milligrams per deciliter to the total serum calcium for each 1 gram of deciliter decrease in albumin below 4.0. So hopefully that's not confusing. I'll repeat that. So you'll add 0.8 milligrams per deciliter to the total serum calcium for each 1 gram per deciliter decrease in albumin below 4.0. So hopefully that makes sense, but easiest way is just measuring ionized. So when we talk about calcium supplementation, really we typically have two options. We have calcium chloride and we have calcium gluconate. So when we talk about when we would give those two medications and how we would make that decision, it may just depend on what we carry. We know in our situation, we actually only carry calcium chloride. Now, with that, we have to be careful because calcium chloride is a vesicant. If it extravasates, you can have tissue necrosis. So typically, this is not recommended to be given through a peripheral IV, especially in a pediatric patient. We can still do that in an adult patient if we're confident in the peripheral access that it is a reliable IV, but really, central is preferred. Now, if we do give calcium gluconate, we have to remember that it only has a third of the free elemental calcium. So typically, you will see higher doses of calcium gluconate given. So typically, about 3 times. If we're given 1 gram of calcium chloride, we would typically give 3 grams of calcium gluconate. Again, we talked about how calcium is a strong inotrope. So if we're having a patient that is hypotensive, especially if they are in a cardiogenic shock, we may see that the physicians want calcium to be supplemented more aggressively than somebody that does not have a cardiogenic pathophysiology. I try to find for this podcast, I try to find like a recommended replacement value, and really that data just doesn't exist. There's not enough studies that really say at a certain level we need to start replacing calcium. So this is really going to be dependent upon your cardiovascular physicians. I know in some of our very sick cardiac patients, they really want to target an ionized calcium of 1.3 millimoles. So just something to keep in mind. Mike talked about transfusion and really with trauma. So if you think about what calcium does, we talked about how it affects inotropy. We talked about how it affects the clotting cascade. We talked about how with blood transfusion, how there's citrate that binds to calcium. So really trauma patients, all three of those can affect them. They may be hypotensive and could use some additional inotropy. They may be getting transfusion and they're obviously bleeding. So by giving calcium, we can affect really all three mechanisms, and we're seeing calcium given very aggressively in our hemorrhagic trauma patients.
So let's touch on hypercalcemia a little bit. As we've already mentioned, hypercalcemia typically is not as clinically significant. Usually our patients tolerate high calcium levels really well, but if we're starting to see extremely high values, this can cause problems. And this can be caused by hyperparathyroidism. Again, the opposite cause of what we talked about with hypocalcemia and having hypoparathyroidism. And then malignancy is a big cause of this as well. Now, when we're considering the fact that calcium is an inotrope, with that inotropic effect, if you have an extreme amount of calcium, you can actually have overactivation of that cardiac muscle, and you can actually see arrhythmias. Well, as we know, arrhythmias can cause symptoms like syncope. So if you have a syncope patient come in, patient that experienced a syncopal episode, what's one of the first things we do? Well, we normally acquire a 12-lead ECG to see if they're having arrhythmias. Well, another component of that and another thing that we should be assessing is obviously their electrolyte values. We've talked about how potassium is a big suspect for these things, but calcium is as well. And we can see high calcium levels in these patients that could potentially need treatment. The biggest thing to keep in mind, and it's not always extremely applicable to us, but if you have any kind of patient that's experiencing rapidly increasing calcium levels, that's going to be a high suspect for malignancy. So keep that in mind as we're treating these patients and making sure that that is part of the assessment if there's not some kind of chronic disease process going on underneath. But other than that, those are the biggest players, and we aren't going to get too much more into that.
When we talk about the treatment of hypercalcemia again, like Mike mentioned, this is usually something that we're not treating. But if we see this, usually it's going to be a chronic situation. The patients are going to be evaluated for a parathyroid surgery where they actually remove some of the parathyroid glands to help reduce that hormone secretion. But some other things that we can do if we were to run across this in an emergent situation would be to give crystalloid boluses. We can give Lasix or a loop diuretic will cause excretion of calcium along with the other electrolytes that we're aware of. And dialysis would be definitive treatment for hypercalcemia. So really that about covers it. Just in summary, we wanted to really just highlight a few of the main points. So remember, we need to use caution when interpreting calcium. We need to make sure that we're looking at ionized calcium. We have to remember that total calcium is affected by a lot of different things. Albumin and pH are the main contributors to the difference between total calcium and ionized calcium. So trust ionized, really, because that's the biologically active form of calcium. That's what's going to affect your body systems. Take that into account. Know what calcium you carry. Know how to administer it. So remember, calcium chloride should be given through central access if you can, especially in pediatric patients. And remember that a higher dose is needed for calcium gluconate if that's what you carry. Remember to keep calcium in mind for trauma patients. We talked about all the ways that it affects it, the clotting cascade, inotropy, and the citrate in banked blood. So all those things can affect our trauma patients. And remember that calcium is a strong inotrope. Again, there's not great data, but many clinicians choose to target normal to high normal values in the presence of cardiogenic related hypotension. So keep those points in mind, and hopefully this helped. We are about sick and tired of electrolytes. I don't know if you're sick and tired of hearing about them, but we're kind of sick and tired of talking about them. So hopefully we have something a little bit more exciting coming up soon. So hang tight.
That about wraps it up. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button if you haven't already. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at HLTH Podcast, or visit our website at heavyliesthehelmet.com. Until next time, this is the Heavy Lies the Helmet Podcast, signing off.